VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. Israel has approved a U.S. negotiated ceasefire with Hezbollah in Lebanon aimed at ending nearly 14 months of fighting linked to the Gaza war. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Have some good news to report from the Middle East.
Hours after Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said his security cabinet signed off on the deal.
This is designed to be a permanent cessation of hostilities.
It would be the first major step toward ending regional unrest after Hamas's attack on Israel more than a year ago. President Biden hopes it can lead to a ceasefire in Gaza, too.
Over the coming days, the United States will make another push.
Still in the hours leading up to the cabinet meeting, Israel carried out its most intense wave of attacks on the Lebanese capital and suburbs, signaling it aims to keep going after Hezbollah before any truce takes hold. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Linda Gradstein has more from Jerusalem.
The Israeli cabinet voted Tuesday to approve the ceasefire deal between Israel and Hezbollah, which will take effect on Wednesday at 10 a.m. local time. Speaking on Israeli TV, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that Israel retains freedom of movement to attack the Iran-backed Shia militant group if it violates the ceasefire. Israeli troops will gradually withdraw from South Lebanon, and acting Lebanese Prime Minister Naguib Mikati said 5,000 Lebanese soldiers will be deployed there. Netanyahu said the ceasefire will enable more than 60,000 residents who have been displaced from their homes in northern Israel to return. But some Israelis are skeptical that the ceasefire will really mean the end to Hezbollah attacks on northern Israel. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
This is VOA News. Moscow awaits Donald Trump's inauguration amid escalating military tensions with Ukraine and Western powers following the Kremlin's use of a new nuclear-capable missile against Ukrainian positions. Elizabeth Chernoff narrates this report from Ricardo Marquina.
Russian President Vladimir Putin's announcement to the world in November that Russia had fired a nuclear-capable hypersonic missile at Ukraine raised further questions on why the escalation is happening only weeks away from the transfer of power in Washington. Putin said the Russian missile firing was a response to the outgoing Biden administration's permission for Ukraine to fire American-supplied missiles deep inside Russia. He said it was meant to show Russia can strike far into NATO territory if it wants to. The Kremlin accuses outgoing U.S. President Joe Biden of sabotaging President-elect Donald Trump's efforts to broker a quick end to the war, as Trump promised to do during his campaign. But some in Washington say Russia is not interested in stopping the war, with or without Donald Trump in the White House. For Ricardo Marquina, Elizabeth Chernoff, VOA News.
Trading partners Mexico, Canada, and China are warning U.S. President-elect Donald Trump that his threat of imposing hefty tariffs on goods would harm the economies of all involved and would risk aggravating inflation. Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener reports.
Trump made a surprise announcement on Monday for a 25% tariff on imports from Canada and Mexico, as well as an additional 10% levy on Chinese goods until they clamped down on drugs like fentanyl and migrants crossing the border. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum on Tuesday said imposing tariffs would cause inflation and job losses and suggested possible retaliation. The United States is by far the dominant destination for vehicles made in Mexico, with up to 79% of them heading north across the border, while Canada is America's biggest supplier of crude oil. Tariffs are paid by the companies that import goods, even though Trump frequently and incorrectly says that tariffs would hit foreign nations instead.
Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener. Rescue operations at a building that collapsed in Tanzania's commercial capital have ended after 10 days as the number of dead rose to 29. A government spokesperson said on Tuesday the owner of the building in Dar es Salaam was arrested and investigations into the November 16th collapse are ongoing. More than 80 people were rescued from the four-story building that housed dozens of shops. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jen Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, November 27th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Israel and Hezbollah agreed to a ceasefire deal.
According to the terms of the ceasefire, Hezbollah will move its soldiers north of the Litani River as called for by UN Resolution 1701. Israeli troops will gradually withdraw from South Lebanon.
Namibians are voting in presidential election today, Wednesday. The UN AIDS agency says upholding human rights is essential for ending the disease. A new report exposes the legal loopholes protecting rapists in Africa. Africa displacement triples, fueled by conflict, violence, and disasters.
5 countries on the African continent are generating the most conflict-related internal displacement. But what our report also shows, as I said, is the disaster displacement is also rising.
And the Liberian government scholarship program comes under criticism. Those stories plus more coming up on Daybreak Africa. Israel and Lebanon have signed a ceasefire agreement after more than 13 months of conflict. According to the deal, Hezbollah troops will move north of the Litani River and Israeli troops will withdraw from South Lebanon. Linda Grasstein reports from Jerusalem.
The Israeli cabinet voted Tuesday to approve the ceasefire deal between Israel and Hezbollah, which will take effect on Wednesday at 10 a.m. local time. Speaking on Israeli TV, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that Israel retains freedom of movement to attack the Iran-backed Shia militant group if it violates the ceasefire. Netanyahu said if Hezbollah violates the agreement and tries to rearm, we will attack. If it tries to rebuild terror infrastructure near the border, we will attack. The prime minister said Israel has set Hezbollah back decades by assassinating Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah, as well as thousands of other Hezbollah fighters, and destroying much of Hezbollah's attack capability. According to the terms of the ceasefire, Hezbollah will move its soldiers north of the Litani River as called for by UN Resolution 1701. Israeli troops will gradually withdraw from South Lebanon, and acting Lebanese Prime Minister Naguib Mikati said 5,000 Lebanese soldiers will be deployed there. Netanyahu said the ceasefire will enable more than 60,000 residents who have been displaced from their homes in northern Israel to return. More than 1 million Lebanese have also been displaced on the other side of the border. But some Israelis are skeptical that the ceasefire will really mean the end to Hezbollah attacks on northern Israel. Middle East expert Eitan Shamir of Bar-Ilan University says Israel has achieved its objectives in the fight against Hezbollah.
We are on a point of diminishing return. A lot of efforts, getting some casualties, and we probably will get more casualties if we continue. On the other hand, most of the damage has already been done to Hezbollah. So the idea from the get-go was not to completely destroy Hezbollah and getting into a situation where it has to surrender. From the minute this campaign was launched, I think there was an understanding that Hezbollah will continue to be a serious actor in Lebanon.
The big question is how the ceasefire deal in Lebanon will affect the ongoing fighting in Gaza. Netanyahu said that Israel will continue to fight in Gaza until Hamas is annihilated and all remaining hostages, both living and dead, are returned. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
A new report from the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center says the number of people displaced in Africa has tripled to 35 million. Of these, 32.5 million abandoned their homes due to conflict and violence. The report, published on Tuesday, says government efforts to address internal displacement on the continent have been commendable, but not enough. Mohamed Yusuf has more on the plight of the displaced.
24-year-old Amani Kalindi has not known peace since he was a boy growing up in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. The truck driver is one of millions of Africans displaced from their homes due to conflict, disasters, and climate change. Kalindi says, "We live in constant fear. Everywhere we go, seeking safety, we face new dangers and are forced to flee again. War has been a constant problem, with foreign armed groups invading our country to fight over its resources and minerals. With nowhere else to turn, he says, he decided to come to Uganda and seek refuge in a camp. Kalindi came to Uganda on Saturday after spending years in Ituri and North and South Kivu provinces in the DRC. Escaping danger, he joined millions of others from Africa and beyond in registering as a refugee. In a new report published Tuesday, the Geneva-based Internal Displacement Monitoring Center says the large majority of people displaced worldwide are in Africa. The report looks at the new trends and developments of the displaced from 2009 to 2023 and finds that the number of people forced from their homes has tripled to 35 million. Almost 93% are displaced due to conflict and violence, and 26 million of them are displaced in just five countries: the Democratic Republic of Congo, Ethiopia, Nigeria, Somalia, and Sudan. Experts say poverty, inequality, and marginalization are among the many factors that fuel conflict and violence, and armed groups have exploited these grievances, which create more displacements. IDMC Director Alexandra Bilak says violence is not solely blamed for the crisis.
So five countries on the African continent are generating the most conflict-related internal displacement. But what our report also shows, as I said, is that disaster displacement is also rising. We are now reporting six times more disaster displacements than 15 years ago.
Floods and droughts trigger the majority of disaster displacements. IDMC researchers warn climate change will make these weather-related events more frequent and intense, and they expect these displacement trends to continue. With the heightening conflict in Sudan, the chronic armed conflict in DR Congo, and weather-related disasters hitting communities, Balik says it's hard to see the numbers going down.
It's hard to be optimistic. We know that with the impacts of climate change, the disasters that we're seeing already today are likely to increase in the future. We have seen prolonged periods of droughts across the Horn of Africa. And without more investments in the underlying causes of this displacement, we fear that the numbers will indeed continue rising.
The Internal Displacement and Monitoring Center knows that some African countries have developed national policies to protect and assist internally displaced persons in accordance with a 2009 African Union agreement. Mohamed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
Namibians are voting today, Wednesday, in presidential election. Among 15 candidates are 37-year-old University Professor Job Amupanda of the Affirmative Repositioning AR Party and a 72-year-old Netumbo Nandi Undetwa, Vice President of the ruling Southwest Africa People's Organization, SWAPO. The Southern African Development Community, SADC, has called for a peaceful vote. Professor Sipho Sipi is a political analyst and a former Deputy Vice Chancellor for Institutional Support at the University of Zululand. He tells me that Namibia is one of the Southern African countries that have been led by liberation movement following independence, but are now being judged on their performance by younger people.
What you find in Southern Africa is countries that were run or led by liberation movements. And for most liberation movements, after 20 years, they start losing the sting. The young people begin to forget or not remember the role that were played by liberation movements that have become ruling parties. And the liberation movements are now judged according to their performance, and not so much about the struggle against colonialism. And Namibia has been, just like South Africa, they are the last of the remaining ruling parties that come from the liberation movement. SWAPO has been in power for 34 years, and Namibia seems to be also facing serious challenges, where young people who constitute more than 50% of the electorate are saying, yes, SWAPO has brought about independence, but SWAPO has not conducted itself very well. At the moment, just like in South Africa, SWAPO is battling with the several challenges of poverty, unemployment, and inequality. So the young people are saying, despite being a party of liberation, it has not been a very good party of government. So for Sobo, it is very concerned that the young people who now form majority might vote for the opposition.
While that may be true, the addition of Ndetwa, the female candidate for SWAPO, could energize the young people.
Yes, but because she comes from SWAPO, I mean, there's a possibility that just because you have a possibility of a first female, there may be some people, even including among young people, saying men have tried and men have disappointed us. Maybe if we have a female president, we might have a mother of the nation who might be more caring. But we also have young people who are saying maybe we need a different party, and that party is not SWAPO.
Talking about the decline of the political parties that brought the countries to independence, is it possible we could see a replay of what happened in Mozambique?
Yeah, you could see that possibility. But the difference between SWAPO or Namibia and Mozambique is that unlike SWAPO or Namibia, in Mozambique we've always had ongoing civil strife. Mozambique has never known peace. And this is why Namibia will be slightly different, because you've not had very strong armed combatants belonging to an opposition party. So one hopes that the SWAPO or Namibia, with its small population, violence can be contained more than you will have a case in Mozambique.
Professor Sipho Sipi is a political analyst and a former deputy vice chancellor for institutional support at the University of Zululand. You are speaking with us from Johannesburg. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Wednesday, November 27th. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. A report by the international NGO Equality Now says the definition of rape in 25 African countries has allowed many perpetrators to go unpunished. Such narrow definition, it says, often allows charges against accused rapists to be reduced to lesser crimes with lower penalties. Lamek Mansina reports from Blantyre.
These findings are part of a 46-page study covering gaps in legislation, implementation, and access to justice for rape victims in 47 African countries. The report says globally, 35% of women have experienced either physical or sexual violence, and that about 33% of women in Africa have experienced sexual violence in their lifetime. High rates of sexual violence have been documented during conflicts in Ethiopia, Sudan, and the Democratic Republic of Congo, says the report, which adds that in those countries, rape was used as a weapon of war to denigrate, disempower, and demoralize communities. Sari Ncube is a regional representative for Southern Africa at Equality Now. She told VOA via a messaging app from Zimbabwe that narrow legal definitions of rape have long promoted impunity for perpetrators in many countries.
For example, concerning rape committed within an intimate partner relationship, or relegate these violations to a lesser offenses with lesser penalties, which creates a hierarchy of abuse and sending a confusing signal about the absolute right of each individual to bodily autonomy.
The report names 25 African countries where the legal definition of rape may be too narrow. They include Cameroon, South Sudan, Chad, Equatorial Guinea, Gabon, Gambia, Mozambique, and Malawi. Zwone Lapani coordinates the Victim Support Unit at the Blanta Police Station in Malawi. She told VOA about a case in which a married woman complained to police after her husband sexually abused her. Lapani said they did not open a case after a discussion with the couple that established that the man forced himself on his wife after being denied sex for so long because of some family matters.
You say, no, this is not much big, because there was something inside you which you didn't communicate. It's no longer rape, but just because the man was tired, because the lady was giving punishment to the man.
An Equality Now report about gaps in family laws released earlier this year found that Malawian customary law presumes perpetual consent to sex within a marriage, and that a wife can deny her husband sex only when she is sick or legally separated. Lamek Masina, VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
Ahead of World AIDS Day on December 1st, the UN has released a report saying that upholding human rights is essential for ending the AIDS pandemic. The report says human rights violations, including discrimination against girls and women and criminalization of LGBTQ people, obstruct efforts to end AIDS. Columbus Mavunga reports from Zimbabwe's capital, where the government continues to criminalize.
UN Executive Director Winnie Byanyima released a report online called Take the Right Path to End AIDS. The report says the world can meet the goal of ending AIDS by 2013 if leaders protect the human rights of everyone living with and at the risk of HIV. She said advances in medicine are helping reduce new cases of HIV.
But big gaps still remain in the protection of rights. When there is impunity for gender-based violence, when people can be arrested for who they are or who they love, when a visit to health services is dangerous for people because of their gender, the result is that people are blocked from care. This drives the AIDS pandemic. Only rights can fix these wrongs. There's an urgent need to enact laws that protect the human rights of everyone. If we take the rights path, we will end AIDS.
Zimbabwe is one of the countries hit hardest by HIV and AIDS until it introduced AIDS levy in 1999, a 3% tax on income and business profits, which is managed by the National AIDS Council. Dr. Bernard Madzima, the executive officer of the Zimbabwe National AIDS Council, says the country is aiming to end HIV as a public health threat by the end of the decade. He said the country enforces a policy of no discrimination against HIV patients.
In Zimbabwe, there's no one who has been stigmatized, whether they're HIV positive or whether they're HIV negative, they will get access. Our approach in HIV intervention is based on it being a public health approach. So our interventions are to make sure that HIV AIDS is no longer a public health threat by 2030.
Madzima says the government is also attempting to reach marginalized groups like sex workers, prison inmates, and informal minors with care. In the past, Zimbabwean authorities targeted sex workers and organizations such as Gays and Lesbians Association of Zimbabwe. The UNAIDS report noted that police only stopped arresting sex workers for loitering in 2015 after Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights successfully argued in court that the police conduct was illegal. The report says that has resulted in sex workers being able to seek health services. Columbus Mavunga, VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
The Liberian government scholarship program for 250 students to study science and technology, engineering and mathematics, also known as STEM, in the United States, has collapsed after Liberians questioned its legitimacy. Dennis Nipson reports from Monrovia.
The government of Liberia is tight-lipped on what was announced as a U.S. $25 million program for 250 Liberian students to study abroad. This after an assistant minister publicly disclosed that the program is a fraud. On November 6, President Joseph Boakai, accompanied by his foreign and information ministers, launched the non-collateral student loan program in partnership with Necotech, a civic organization that claims to empower African youth with global education opportunities in STEM. However, Assistant Minister for Information Matthew Yemplu warned the public in a Facebook post not to invest in the program because he said it is committing fraud by extorting money from struggling Liberian students. Yemplu, who was immediately suspended by President Boakai, resigned and spoke to VOA about his allegations.
This is the scheme Necotech is playing on Liberians. They are taking money from Liberians under the pretext of a guaranteed work-study program in the United States. And we have maintained that a work-study program is federally funded by the U.S. government. It's a kind of financial aid program for students who are in need but they have to study. No non-U.S. private actor can for certain promise that the students can benefit from work-study program in the United States.
Applicant Newon Sua says she was added to a group of 1,000 other Liberian applicants but could not continue after being asked to pay US$236 as readiness fees for what was announced by the government to be a loan.
I had to pay for what they call conversion of your grades into the U.S. GPA, and that is done online through a link that you have to use your Visa card to have that converted. The cost is $11.99 based on the initial email I received. After all that $11.99, which I just thought that was just it, before I got to the readiness fees, that was $236. That for me brought a concern to me that from the public information that I have, this program is supposed to be a graduate loan by the government of Liberia.
Foreign Ministry spokesperson Sewaba told VOA the ministry halted the Necotech scholarship for the time being. Dr. Princess Okansi is Necotech's chief executive officer. She said US$236 is a training fee to prepare students for English proficiency test training. USA School Admissions Co-Selection Assistance and Review Loan Applications. The money is also used for visa interview coaching and applications financial literacy. However, she claims the fee has been waived for Liberians for the spring 2025 entry to the USA. For Daybreak Africa, I'm Denise Nipson in Monrovia, Liberia.
The son of one of Mali's top politicians says the country's ruling junta has arrested his father for criticizing the military rulers of neighboring Burkina Faso. The Associated Press reports that Issa Kawu Njem was previously a supporter of Mali's current military leader, Colonel Assimi Goïta, before distancing himself from the junta. His son and a court source said that Njem was arrested on charges of insulting a foreign head of state, which is a crime in Mali. Njem had claimed on the Joliba TV news broadcaster on Sunday that the military rulers of Burkina Faso, a close ally of Mali, made up evidence of a foiled coup in November. And that's it for this Wednesday, November 27th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming aboard with us this morning. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington.
Hello, this is Lina Mudu, host of Health Chat. Join me for the latest in health news, wellness tips, medical breakthroughs, and much more. Our experts inside the United States and beyond will share some insights on living a healthy life. Tuesdays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA.
We are bringing women voices to the conversation on things that matter to the hearts and minds of women. From right here in the nation's capital to on the ground from all over the African continent. We hear your voices. Our voices. Right here on VOA.